Dialect Radio. This week we hear from Abby Jamet about being born in Bristol but growing up in Africa and what it was like to come back. Also this week we hear about Co-Mutiny Week. Katie Austin reports from Bristol's Organic Food Fair, and we hear more about the Freemasons, not the pop group, but the religious cult, or are they, who have a Bristol temple at the bottom of Park Street. This week we hear from an ex-Freemason about Masonic presidents of the United States, and Chris Owen Childs talks again about his trip to South America with the Lord Mayor of London. Okay, well, I'd like to introduce Abby Jamet to the studio. Hello.
Hello.
So how long have you been back in Britain?
In Britain?
Yeah.
7 years.
Okay, and sort of tell us a little bit. You were born in Bristol and you lived here till you were two, but
yeah.
Where did you move after that?
When I was two, my parents moved out to the Indian Ocean. My father had grown up there. My mother was from Bristol. And we lived in an island called Reunion Island till I was about 13. And then we moved to the Comores, which is an archipelago of it's four islands off the coast of Mozambique before you hit Madagascar.
Okay.
And we lived on an island called Mayotte. And then when I was 15, I moved to Kenya, and I studied there till I was 17, and that's when I came back to Britain,
okay.
To Bristol.
So what did you study when you came back to Britain?
I did my A-levels.
Yeah.
In Thornbury.
Yeah.
And then I took a gap year, and then I went to university, and I just finished. Hooray.
Cool. What did you get?
I got a degree.
Yeah.
In Arabic and the history of the Middle East.
Cool. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Now, for a lot of people, like life living up, growing up in Madagascar will be sort of, or somewhere like that will be sort of completely alien. I mean, how many other sort of white or English or sort of European people did you were around you in these places where you lived?
Well, it depended from island to island. The first island, Reunion Island, has a very multi-ethnic population because there were no indigenous people there before. So you have people from all over Asia, from Europe, from Africa. So I guess there were very few people who had one ethnicity. But you had people from everywhere. And it's quite a modern place because it's a French department. So there was a lot of French people there, French teachers, etc.
Okay.
And in fact, it's considered as France. So the culture was very Western. When we moved to the Comores, so that was 10 years back, it was much more African. There was an indigenous population there. There were very few white people, some people from South Africa who are business people, and also sort of French administrators and teachers and things like that. But I was homeschooled, so I actually knew very little people in general.
Okay.
But no, yeah, like the actual, it was a much more, a much less French atmosphere and culture.
Okay.
And then in Kenya, I was in a boarding school for international people. So I had friends from all over Africa and then all over the world, actually. But it was a boarding school that was set in the middle of nowhere.
Okay.
In terms of urban sort of stuff.
Was that much more exciting, sort of living with people of your own age who are,
yeah.
You know, are also from all over the place as well?
Yeah, it was. It was very interesting because I had roommates who had been evacuated from the Congo twice. I knew people who lived in Rwanda while there was the war going on, and I got to visit people in their homes and see things like bullet holes in the walls because they lived in Uganda and Idi Amin had his people there, and it really opened my eyes. And at the same time, it's really nice because you have a common experience, so you feel you don't have to explain certain things, like the fact that maybe you feel like you belong to a lot of places, but you don't understand them maybe thoroughly,
yeah,
and things like that.
I mean, if you your mother is originally from Bristol, you say.
Mm.
I mean, do you sort of consider what do you consider you, what they call your mother sort of tongue, more French or more English?
Yeah. People ask me that all the time. I don't know. I really don't know. I was two when we left. And I know that I didn't speak French because I have memories of having to learn French at school. But I didn't really speak English from the age of two to the age of 15. My mother was very adamant that I learn how to read English.
Yeah.
So I learned how to read really early on, and she would make me read books every week, every month.
Okay.
So I think I had this store of vocabulary in my head. And then when I went to boarding school, which was an English-speaking school, I had to switch into the English education system from the French when I was 15. And in the space of that year, I lost all my French. Like,
really?
I couldn't speak a word of French. And I think it's just one of those things. I was able to get the English because I'd read so much in English. But my brain couldn't cope. It's taken me a long time to get my French back to scratch.
Yeah, that must mess with your sort of sense of identity a little bit.
Yeah.
Sort of talking and changing.
Yeah, I think so. It took me a long time to be able to make jokes in English, for example.
Okay.
I still find it a little bit inhibit, like, for example, now.
Yeah.
Like, when I'm nervous, it's hard. I still count in French. When I'm really angry, it'll come out in French.
Ah, right. Well, that's what really counts, I think.
Yeah, I know.
If you swear in French, then.
Yeah.
What sort of books did your mother sort of have you reading? Was it?
Anything.
Yeah.
I think the classics. Anne of Green Gables, Thomas Midnight Garden.
Oh, right.
Dickens.
Okay. Dickens, good lord. That's pretty heavy going for a
young child.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, but I think I loved reading as well.
Okay.
So sometimes you read a book and you don't actually understand the book because you're reading so many books, but just looking at the sentences.
Yeah. When you came back, you say you lived with your grandmother. What was that like? Had you ever met her?
I did. Yeah, I knew my grandmother, but not very well, because I'd see her for a couple of weeks every year or every 2 years. I didn't know her very well, no.
Okay, I mean, when you lived here only for 2 years, and it's your first 2 years, so I guess you don't sort of really remember anything, but did you feel like you should, I don't know, feel any sense of familiarity with Britain? It must have seemed like, even though it's where you're from originally, it must have seemed like a pretty alien place to be going to. What's that feel like?
Yeah, it was actually. It was it was one of the hardest things I've done, because I had just come from the open spaces of Kenya, where you live outdoors all the time. And I was living in my grandmother's house in Bristol, which is very rainy and where you can't do a lot of things outside. And so I found it very hard because I didn't understand the landscape, if you know what I mean. I didn't know what to wear. I didn't know.
Whereabouts in Bristol did you live?
I lived in Thornbury, which is a little village, a market town.
Yeah, really claustrophobic then.
Well, I think that anywhere that wasn't Africa would have felt claustrophobic. I remember walking into the mall at Cribbs Causeway, and I actually was so shocked by how much there was to offer in the shops that I had to leave the mall because I thought I was going to be ill. I actually had never seen and understood, because I was 17 at that point, what it actually meant for there to be so much on sale, because I'd just come from a very poor country. I thought it was really weird. I still think it's really weird sometimes.
Now, that'll probably be quite interesting to a lot of listeners, because a mall like that is often seen as very sort of high street and a bit limiting.
Yeah, you know, I know.
To you, like, that must have been completely alien. I mean, what sort of interaction with sort of the locals and sort of Africans did you sort of? How did you interact with them? Just sort of hang out with?
Yeah.
How did you sort of interact with the
local people
in all these various places?
Well, I mean, it was home. So it wasn't... my parents always made a point of not living secluded from the local culture.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So I went to school with people. I saw them on the streets. I bought stuff from their shops. I didn't, at some level, you know that you don't belong there because you don't have, I don't know, you weren't born there, for example. You when you arrive, you have to learn things like the street names and you have to understand what the food is and things like that. So you know you don't belong there. But at the same time, it's these are the people of your everyday life.
Mm.
And so I wanted to get to know them, and it's easy to also. I think my parents lived in a village, like a real village, because before we lived in the capital, and my sister went to the local schools, and she picked up the language really fast. And because it was a Muslim country, there were lots of things like we had to dress really, really modestly, and when we lived in the village, often we'd had to wear headscarves and things like that, which I think for some people it's a really, really big deal, because wearing a headscarf or not wearing a headscarf is a real mark of your identity.
Yeah.
But one of the things that it really taught me was to see, like, well, what, like, I don't really want to wear something that's covering my shoulders, but for my neighbours it's really offensive if I don't.
Okay.
Well, and in that respect, I understood that I was a guest and that I had to make that effort.
Do you often feel, I mean, coming from somewhere where you've grown up sort of experiencing poverty of the people surrounding you as sort of the norm, how do you find the attitude of people in Britain to sort of poverty? It must be very different from your attitude.
Yeah, I think it is. I was telling you, like, on one hand, it feels like it's ignored a lot of the time, and people don't realise that it exists.
Does that sort of make you a bit angry, having known that firsthand, so to speak?
Well, I guess angry, but it's just genuinely confusing. You think, how can people live in the same world? And genuinely, like, I don't think people are malicious when they don't understand how rich they really are, or when they kind of don't realise that when you have a war and you have famine and you have places, you know, you can be really sarcastic and cynical about appeals for famine and things like that.
Yeah.
I feel the same way. But you have this kind of abstraction from what's going on. But it's a genuine sort of feeling of not understanding. And I find that very, very strange, because for me it wasn't a concept.
Okay.
It is a reality.
Well, thank you very much for coming. We've got to wrap up now, unfortunately, and I could have spoken for a lot longer. But where are your parents now? Are they living in Britain as well?
Yeah, they are. They moved to Bristol.
Okay. Do you often feel like you miss sort of where you've grown up? Do you want to go back there?
I went, but that's not where I am now. So I think it's important to pay attention to what's going on here.
All right. Well, best of luck in the future. And
thank you.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk. Okay.
Well, I'd like to introduce to the studio Mr. Ben Ritchie. Hello.
Hi there.
You're here to chat about Co Mutiny Week. Tell us, what's that about?
It's a whole series of events, conferences, direct action, organised by a whole coalition of activists all over the country coming to Bristol, including climate change people, environmentalists, animal rights, people involved in actions to do with the economic crisis, housing crisis, all coming together to see what they can do to present an alternative vision of the world other than the one we unfortunately currently are in.
Okay. Well, I mean, we did hear about the Green Gathering, which that was sort of a meeting of minds that were all interested in green energy, and well, the police managed to get that one shut down. So how's the setup of Co-Mutiny been in terms of sort of police interactions?
Well, luckily we've run this on a complete budget. We haven't had to get any permission at all to carry out the activities. So we've been able to go forward and get our building where we've held the conferences without police interference.
Okay.
Of course, the police do know where we are,
yeah,
and they're just maintaining a minimal presence outside the building.
Okay, good. Well, what's the philosophy behind this this big meeting?
I think now that we're in a world that's got two crises running in parallel, one is the climate crisis, and of course we're also in the economic crisis, and activists from across the spectrum are getting together to say, let's do something about it. And we're coming to Bristol because it's a city where there's an awful lot of activity, and we're trying to reach out to people throughout Bristol to come and learn about what we can do to create a better world.
Right, where and when is this taking place, and can people sort of get involved?
Well, I think we'd be more than delighted if people turned up at the Pro Cathedral, which is on Park Place in Clifton. Mm-hmm. That's a centre. The police are sitting outside, but it's only one police van. They are photographing people, but I think it shouldn't stop people to go in and see what can be done. The Pro Cathedral has been completely cleaned, and it is a remarkable transformation within a few days of what was a derelict building. There are various workshops going on in there, and if people want to be involved in any of the other actions, they can find out from the people up there what's going on. There's also food by donation, and people can stay up there if they wish to.
Okay, I mean, what do you hope will sort of come of this in terms of its effect on the general public, particularly in relation to sort of the economic crisis? What's your sort of vision for what could happen?
Well, I think it's very important that people don't just go back in a kind of very narrow way to the Conservatives, thinking that if we cut services, if we punish the poor more, we'll get out of the crisis. I think we need more of a vision to say we need alternative energy development, we need to look at transport, housing, use of the environment, carry out measures to stop global warming. We need a completely different way of looking at the world and completely different actions other than the ones being put forward at the moment. So, and we hope that, you know, we can just get people thinking in Bristol about these things.
Do you feel a bit frustrated that a lot of the visions that are coming forward for the future, the better ones, seem to be mostly coming from the bottom up, and the visions of those at the top don't really seem to be based around green energy and the things that you're talking about?
I think you'll find that in a really serious crisis, this is what you get, is that the people at the top are really locked into the system. It's what they know, it's what they're paid to do. Mm. It's their interest to stay as it is. It's the people at the bottom who have nothing to lose that are going to come up with really, really original ideas. I mean, you can go back to the diggers in the English Civil War if you want to look at that kind of thing, or right far back, right to the time of the Roman Empire if you want to go right that far back and look at the Christians. You know, these are new people.
Okay, I mean, what are you personally hoping? What is your sort of part of this, and what are you going to get out of it by the end of it?
Well, we're very pleased what's going on in the cathedral, because it shows that people can get together, transform a building, live peaceably together. We've also got a squatters advice agency running down on the Emporium down on Stokes Croft.
Yep.
And we're showing that there's enough space in Bristol for everyone to have somewhere to live. Mm-hmm. So our particular angle, or my particular political angle, is to bring up the whole issue of housing, show that squatting is one of the ways out, and to make it quite apparent that we've got more than enough places for people to live, that the housing crisis is an artificial one to suit the needs of an artificial system.
Okay, so the Pro Cathedral in Park Place at Clifton, how long is this going on for?
It'll be going on till Sunday, you know, provided we're allowed to go on. But I think because it's been run very well, relationships with the police are reasonable.
Okay.
We should be there till the end of the programme.
Okay, so the police mostly are sort of happy that you've cooperated well?
Well, I'm not sure whether cooperation is the right word. I mean, people do have dialogue with the police. As we're dealing with a whole series of different groups, all with their different attitudes to authority and the police, you can't really say there's one line.
Mm.
So it does make it problematic. But yeah, people are not necessarily going out of their way to rub the police's nose in things. So the police have kept a minimal presence at the cathedral.
Okay, well, I wish you the very best of luck with it, and I hope it all goes well. Thank you, Ben Ritchie.
Thank you.
Well, let's hit a little flavour of the 60s now. This is Kenny Ball and his jazz band with fantastic Midnight in Moscow. Thank you. That was Midnight in Moscow by Kenny Ball and his Jazz Men.
BCFM Community Radio for Bristol on 93.2 FM. For more information or to listen live on the internet, go to our website at www.bcfm.org.uk. BCFM, your radio.
Our next interview is with Chris Owen Childs, who went to South America with the Lord Mayor of London around 1998. And this is his impression of Peru, Chile and Argentina.
I'm Chris Owen Childs. I spent a lifetime in the construction industry and had some very interesting experiences. At one stage, I had the privilege of being seconded to the Department of Trade and Industry. And I was asked to look at Latin America. And the reason that I was asked to look at Latin America was that I had no preconceived ideas. I had no experience whatsoever. And I was asked, what did I think of Latin America? And all I had in my mind was the hearsay. The hearsay at that time was that Latin America was full of militaristic regimes, that it was autocratically run, that it was a dangerous place, and that really it was not the sort of place that anybody would want to do business. That gave me an introduction in that that was a perception which was widely held, and I was asked to look at the harsh realities which existed. Over the next few months and indeed years, I became involved in Latin America and was excited by what I found. I was particularly interested in Chile, which was a country of enormous capability, wealth and development. They do say in Chile that when God created the world, he kept all of the best bits and gave it to Chile. And there is an element of truth in that. In Chile, there is a perception that the country is at the end of the universe because nobody really went there and passed through on their way to anywhere else. In the time that I've been involved, that has changed. Chile is now seen to be a moving power on the edge of the Pacific Rim. And Latin America, the whole attitude has changed. And this attitude of change was something which I found very striking indeed. Bearing in mind that I had a view that they were militaristic regimes, when I went into Chile, I found a very active democracy. I also was very struck by the reputation of Pinochet. There was a feeling, and particularly pervading in this country, that Pinochet was a dictator who was really very aggressive and totally immoderate. My experience was that Pinochet actually enabled democracy to come into Chile. And the way that this happened was that there was a democratic movement, and the democratic movement gained force, and Pinochet allowed that to take place on condition that it actually worked and was good for the people, because he took the view that if it wasn't good for the people, that he would bring his regime, his fascist regime, as I guess it would have been, back into being. Very quickly, a democracy became established in Chile. The model worked really very well, and it suited the rest of Latin America. And one by one, the countries of Latin America all changed. And there is only one territory left to change into a democracy, and that's Cuba. And the strong belief is that before too long, Cuba also will become democratic. And this total lack of political inertia is such a contrast to what we find in Europe and to what indeed we have in the United Kingdom. It's an interesting reflection on the interest that we have as the media and our preconceived ideas as to how really wrong they can be. We do need to keep open minds, we do need to look at the facts, we do need to consider the real realities, to go and look and find out for ourselves. As a part of my involvement in Latin America, I worked with the London Chamber of Commerce and Industry, and I sat on the various committees who had an interest in the Latin America arena, and that gave me the enormous privilege of leading a mission into Latin America jointly with the Lord Mayor of London. And that mission is still the largest commercial trade mission which has gone into the Southern Cone region. We visited Peru, Chile and Argentina, and the Lord Mayor travels with the senior ministerial privilege, which meant that we had direct access to the heads of government, and tremendous opportunity to talk to and meet with opposite number ministers. The interesting scenario, as far as we were concerned, from the London Chamber, was that the promotion of the City of London was being done by experts in the City of London, but who were not particularly familiar with the region. Whereas the people who were travelling with the London Chamber were very familiar with the region. So it gave us unprecedented access, and we were able to have very deep discussions at a very high level. It is one of the great benefits that ministerial involvement and the Foreign Office involvement in country gives us. It's something that most people are not aware of. It's very powerful. It is not threatening in any way to anybody. But it does reflect the respect which is held between two countries, and the respect between the United Kingdom and Peru, Chile and Argentina is very high, and it has been for many years. The visitors who come into the United Kingdom from Latin America have the same sort of access, and that access is focused on Canning House in London. Canning House is the meeting point where the ministers, where the ambassadors all come together in informal discussion. And a lot of business is done, and a lot of the conditions which are good for business and the legal requirements are sorted out.
Can you tell us a bit about Buenos Aires, being in the capital?
Buenos Aires was, and still is, a very active and live capital. Very bustling, very international, tremendous Italian influence. But the energy which exists in the capital is just unbelievable. It has to be experienced. But it has a lot of character, which is fundamentally European. The metro system has overtones of Paris. A lot of the architecture is Italianate. It is a fabulous place. One of the things that really strikes you when you go to the capitals of Latin America is the architecture. The architecture is fundamentally European and it's classical. Any feeling that you might have that these are developing countries, it would be totally unfounded. There are countries which have a European-based history going back 150, 200 years. Particularly British engineers were deeply involved in the turn of the 19th century in providing railways and infrastructure. So it's not a region which you can consider to be undeveloped. It's very highly developed.
Did you see any legacy of the dictatorship when you were there?
There is a feeling that you get from time to time that there was oppression in the past, and I have seen vehicles, police vehicles in Chile, which apparently were on the street at the time of the disappearing. I was aware of people, say, flinching is a little strong, but certainly unhappy to see these police vehicles. But this is a while ago. The situation was improving. The nervousness was going. But it was there. It was an awareness. There were photographs of people who had disappeared. Concern being expressed. Things were changing, obviously improving, but the history will take some while to heal.
What about Lima in Peru?
Oh, Lima is a very exciting city. An interesting city from the point of view, it's probably the most benign climate in the world. It's covered in dust for a lot of the year because there is virtually no air movement at all. So there's a fairly high level of dust which lasts for quite a long time, about 4 months of the year, and it's the northern edge of the dry zone of which Santiago in Chile is the southern edge, and the centre of it is the Atacama Desert, which is the driest part of the world. I remember walking through the desert, shuffling through the dust, which is up to almost knee height, and being very concerned that I might be bitten by something unpleasant, but my guide assured me that nothing lived in that place at all. But Lima, as a city, it has a long way to go in terms of improvement and investment. But nevertheless, it has tremendous character, and Peru is very much up and coming.
Well, that was Chris Owen Childs there talking to Anthony Page, and thank you for his contribution. Freemasons. Are they a harmless club of quaint old men or a religious cult? You have to believe in an afterlife and in God to become a member. But which God? Whatever you know or don't know, why don't we find discussions taking place about Freemasonry on the BBC or in the mainstream press? Do they use their influence to stop such programmes reaching the airwaves? Or is it simply because so little is known about them outside the dark Masonic temples? One of the most compelling theories is that innocent Masons conceal a more chilling secret society called the Illuminati within their circles, a sort of secret society within a secret society. One of the first authoritative books exposing Masonic rituals was Darkness Visible, published in the United States by Walton Hanna in 1952. Among the reams of conspiracies written about the Freemasons, the only really authoritative ones come from ex-Freemasons. One ex-Freemason believes the famous Victorian Jack the Ripper case is much better understood when one recognises Masonic symbolism. He also contests the idea that the first president of the United States, George Washington, was an active Freemason. Bill Schnurbelin asks, is Freemasonry about more than just privilege and promotion?
These are examples of how Masons can cause a miscarriage of justice. But here is probably the most celebrated example of this in the history of the West. Jack the Ripper, a Freemason? The answer to that question is yes, one way or another. Let me explain. For those of you that may not know, Jack the Ripper is probably the Western world's first known serial killer. He murdered 8 prostitutes in Whitechapel district of London in the year 1888, and he had the whole city of London terrified. This was Victorian England, mind you, and nothing like this had ever happened in the history of England that anybody knew of. And here's what happened. They mounted a huge investigation. The man in charge of the investigation was Police Commissioner Warren, who was a Freemason. At that time, the Prime Minister of England, as is often the case, was a Freemason. The heir presumptive to the throne of England, the Duke of Clarence, was also a Mason. And the physician to the royal court at the time, Dr. Gull, was a Freemason. Now, here's what actually happened. The 8 women who were killed, if you study this, and I happen to have been, before I even became a Mason, I was kind of a Jack the Ripper buff. I'd read several of the books about him and kind of studied up. And when I became a Mason, I realized that the horrible way these unfortunate women were murdered was in accord with Masonic ritual gestures. Just one of them had her throat cut from ear to ear, another one had her bowels ripped out of her body and thrown over her left shoulder, and so on and so on. These were Masonic ritual murders. But why? Well, here's what happened. Believe it or not, the Duke of Clarence, who was second in line to the throne of England, had fallen in love with a prostitute named Annie Crooks. And he married this woman. Now, that was bad enough. But he had a child by her, a little girl. And this woman, horror of horrors, was a Roman Catholic. Now, if you understand the way the Parliament and the monarchy work in England, there is a law that no member of the royal family can ever marry a Roman Catholic because of the adversarial relationship that existed for centuries between the Church of Rome and the Church of England. And so this would have shaken the very foundations of the throne of England. So Dr. Gull, who was a physician and surgeon, had Annie Crooks committed to a mental institution where she died by suicide several months later, because of course in those days mental hospitals were not really Club Med, not that they are today either. The little girl, who was 2 or 3 at most, was placed in a Catholic orphanage. But every woman in Whitechapel, from Catherine Beddoes to Mary Jane Kelly, that knew of the wedding and knew any crooks were horribly murdered to conceal the secrets of a brother master mason. Now, you'll notice the thing up there on the board says the Jewess will not be blamed for nothing. Now, you might wonder, what the heck does that mean? Well, this phrase was scrawled on an alley in Whitechapel during the height of the hysteria. What does that phrase mean? Well, believe it or not, Police Commissioner Warren ordered it immediately struck from the alley. It was taken off the alley, erased. He claimed it was because he did not want to have anti-Semitic riots, because he was afraid people would believe the Jews were out there killing prostitutes. Actually, that was a lie. This term, Jewess, is actually a Masonic code word. It refers to the three ruffians who murdered Hiram Abiff, Jubalo, Jubalah, and Jubalum. And this was a kind of roundabout way of saying the Masons will not be blamed for nothing. Now, if you want any further proof of this, I would direct your attention to what Jack the Ripper originally called himself, because he wrote letters describing his atrocities. And obviously, whether it was Dr. Gull or whether it was an accomplice who worked with Dr. Gull, we don't know. But we do know this. Many people have remarked that the killings themselves were obviously done by someone who was a surgeon. The cuts were done very, very carefully and with an extremely profound knowledge of human anatomy. Anyway, the first time, before Jack was called Saucy Jack or Jack the Ripper, the first nickname he gave himself was Leather Apron. Now, every Mason, when they are made a Master Mason, is given a white lambskin or leather apron. That is the badge of a Mason. Now, this illustrates how Masonry can be used and is often used to conceal crimes, even for a century. Now, let's move on. We'll talk now about the craft and politics, everybody's favorite subject. Most politicians, as everybody has probably observed, tend to be lawyers. As we've already discussed, most lawyers are Masons. Therefore, a lot of politicians are Masons. Many heads of state are Masons. At least 17 presidents of the United States have been Freemasons. Let's talk about the Revolutionary War period. I've already mentioned that Benjamin Franklin was a Mason. Franklin, Benedict Arnold, Paul Revere, George Washington, possibly Jefferson. We don't know that for sure. John Adams was a strong anti-Mason, though. Now, let me talk for a moment about Washington, though. The Masons make an incredible amount of hay out of the fact that Washington was a Mason. I mean, I'm sure some of you have even seen, like around the time of Washington's birthday, they have ads in the paper, you know, showing Washington presiding over the Grand Lodge and so on and so on. Let me tell you something. All of that is basically fiction. I document in my book, Masonry Beyond the Light, the fact that, yeah, Washington was a Mason. He joined when he was an officer in the British Army in his youth, dare I say, before he knew better. Additionally, in those days, if you wanted to get anywhere in the officers' corps of the British Army, you had to be a Mason. But I have a letter documented in my book that proves that at the end of his life, Washington wrote a clergyman, and he said that he had not been inside of a Masonic lodge for 30 years. So much for him being a devout Mason. I think he basically figured out early on that there was nothing that he needed to belong to and basically just walked away from it. There was no teaching in those days that you had to renounce Masonry or do anything like that, and so he just basically stopped going. And he made that very clear. Plus, on his deathbed, he denounced Masonry because he had discovered it had become a tool for bringing the Illuminati into America. How about 20th century politics? Look at all these darlings of the conservative right. Jesse Helms, Bob Dole, Strom Thurmond, Ronald Reagan, who was made an honorary Mason, Gerald Ford, Harry Truman, and Franklin D. Roosevelt. All of these people were high-level Masons, with the exception of Reagan, who was just made an honorary Mason. Now, think of that. All of these people, except Reagan, have taken Holy Communion out of a human skull, because that's what's involved in being a 33rd degree Mason. And you would not believe the oath that these people have to take. They swear that they will work for the destruction of law, religion, and government. And then you wonder why this is so bizarre today in our government, our political system. Freemasonry has been called America's civil religion, and rightly so. You will often find Masonic worshipful masters laying the cornerstones for civic buildings. I'm sure some of your civic buildings, like post offices or courthouses, have had blessings by Masonic worshipful masters. And of course, a blessing from a worshipful master is like a curse.
That was ex-Freemason Bill Schnoebelen there, and you can hear more from Bill on the internet in his film Light Behind Masonry.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Well, this is for all you Freemasons out there. This is a little taste of Jamaica for you, David Assel Collins with Double Barrel.
I'm back, but the shaker was so boss, most thundering, storming, sound of soul. I am W-O-O-O. I'm still here.
That's David Ansel Collins there with Double Barrel from the 70s. It's now time for a little bit of secrets and lies. Conspiracy theories. Love them or hate them. Most of us still have an opinion one way or the other. Investigative journalist and historian David Southwell has been doing his best to get to the bottom of some of his favourite enigmas. In Secrets and Lies, he confirms the old saying that truth really is stranger than fiction when you take the time out to scry out the hard facts behind the smokescreen of rumours and disinformation. David doesn't pretend to have all of the answers, but he has applied an investigative journalist's eye to many enigmas, modern and not so modern. This week, secret orders on reporting civilian deaths in the Afghanistan conflict. The US military learnt some important lessons in Vietnam, though George W. Bush seems to have forgotten the one about not being popular with the citizens of a country you're occupying against their wishes. One of the biggest is that you're in the mass media age. Reports of innocent civilian casualties are unpopular with the folks back home. Rather than changing the way they wage war, military commanders set about minimising reports of military actions that have caused widespread civilian casualties. A number of techniques were developed, such as labelling civilian casualties collateral damage and embedding TV crews with military units to keep them under more control. In recent military campaigns, army press teams have been trained that reports of civilian deaths can be countered with lines such as, They deliberately placed civilians at known military targets, and collateral damage is inevitable in these situations. When it came to the US war in Afghanistan, reporters had a large degree of help with their work on minimising the impact of civilian deaths from the US media. CNN ordered its reporters to, quote, frame reports of civilian deaths with reminders that, quote, the Pentagon has repeatedly stressed it is trying to minimise such casualties, and to remind viewers that the Taliban regime continues to harbour terrorists who are connected to the September 11th attacks that claimed thousands of innocent lives in the US. Fox News anchor Brit Hume even said about reporting civilian casualties, war is hell, people die. The fact that some people are dying, is that really big news? Fox pundit Michael Barron also commented, civilian casualties are not news. The fact is that they accompany wars. All in all, an interesting take on Fox's slogan, we report, you decide. Many newspapers followed suit, with one paper reminding reporters, do not use, in capital letters, photos on page one showing civilian casualties from the US war on Afghanistan. Do not use, again, capitals, wire stories that lead with civilian casualties from the US war on Afghanistan. Truth is indeed the first casualty of war, just before the civilians. Yeah, and thank you very much to David Southwell, who had not a problem at all with this quoting his material. In fact, he was most pleased. Well, time for another episode now, read by Malcolm Greaves of The Diary of an Innkeeper, written by John Fothergill back in the 1920s. He was a guy who decided he was going to run an inn, and he moved his family to Tame in Oxfordshire to run the Spread Eagle Inn. He was new to being a landlord, and the people and the customers he came across were not what he was used to or expecting, so he wrote this diary.
An Innkeeper's Diary by John Fothergill. Champagne buying. Having bought £1,100 worth of wine last year, I thought I must invest also in champagne. So I wrote to one of the best firms asking for a small reserve. They replied that they had completed their reserve list and regretted that they could not comply with my request. I told this story to Charles Nielsen, stockbroker and friend, who said, "That's absurd. Write for 60 dozen, enclosing a cheque for it, which I'll give you, and see what happens." It did happen, and one of the directors came down, he told me afterwards, out of inquisitiveness. A courteous elderly man, and we sat and talked in the garden. The reserve being agreed to, he turned to me and said, "And now, Mr. Fothergill, may I give you back your cheque? It will not be due for 6 months." The grandfather of Katie, Phyllis, Bessie and Ella Lomas, our blessed maids, was brought here from Nottingham in 1880 to look after the gasworks. 2 years ago, then 75, his life was despaired of by the doctors, and we gave him the brandy with which, and not with the doctors, he came to life again. He was told not to work any more by the directors, now become generous, who gave him a pension. Some months later, having been told that he was still working, I met him in the street and asked him why. He replied, "I don't consider it honest to take money without doing any work." And he is still at it all day, and sometimes hard at it. Now, November 1930, I believe he has really retired. Gerald and Mrs. Gould for the night, after an absence of 4 years, once hardy periodicals. I asked him if his monogamy wasn't thought one of the cleverest and brightest pieces of imagination ever written, and he said it was not well received. He told me how, once the first poem was written, the rest came so rapidly and so pat that it took him just 2 days to copy them down, tinker them up and finish. I asked him why no one had ever written on the animology of authors, and he said Pirandello seemed to have done so in his 6 characters, which he said he himself had turned down in a review as being too dull to read. He said that Francis Meynell told him of his staying at a grand house full of county, where by some accident it was discovered that he was a literary person. So an old gentleman took him aside, saying, "Look here, it would be a damn good thing if a good deal more henty were read these days." I showed a woman into number 12, where in a heavy deep frame there is a magnificent Victorian group of fruit in sculptured flannel, polychrome on a black background. "How splendid!" she enthusiastically cried. "I wish they did more of that nowadays." Now, by a sudden access of telepathy, I thought I caught a ring in her voice that was neither archaeological nor aesthetic, so I asked why. "Well, you see," she replied earnestly, "I'm an Australian, and it would increase the sale of wool." After the commemorative crowds, it is a sweet undertaking to have for dinner only 28, and give them really nice food in peace and quiet. Of inmates, Miss Robertson, very pretty, and a friend who have come for a week's painting, where even Tonks and Steer could find none, though it is true Mark Gerstler painted and sold a picture of the garden. Charles and beautiful Claire Nielsen, and two others. Of undergraduates, Peter Colfax, Alfred Bight, and Donegal, Clive, Nog Dugdale, Adam Chetwynd, the constant Grant Lawson, and their little parties. Of Catholics, Norfolk, Girouard and Dornay, and as each of these went out, lovable, they thanked me, as if the great wonder had been theirs and not mine. Oh, my God. And this at the end of Kate's birthday, who had issued to us invitation cards to tea, games and dancing at Dinton Castle, a ruined folly on the Aylesbury Road. It is one of the prettiest sights in the district. We took the newly bought wireless box and listened to tales of our glorious empire and played hide and seek. A fine fellow, a journalist of some repute, wrote to me that he wanted to come here and perhaps write about the place. I replied, rather deprecating the writing. At lunchtime today, Sunday, he turned up in the yard with a car and a lady. "I didn't know you were coming," I said. "Didn't you get my second letter?" he snapped. "No." "You're lying." To which I replied, "Anyhow, it's not worth disputing about." "No, but you're a liar for all that." No letter reached me, even afterwards. I sent up his bags and then hinted that I'd be introduced to the lady, the silent witness of this comic advent. "Mrs. B," he grudgingly announced. But somehow, though he had asked for a room, I began to think that not he alone but both were staying here. "Is the lady staying too?" "Yes." "And then you want two rooms?" "No, I said a double room." "Oh, but really you make it very embarrassing for me."
"Why?"
"Because you're not married, and I discourage indiscriminate coupling here."
"That's not your business."
"But it is."
"You mean you think you can ask everyone who comes here if they're married?"
"Yes, if I want to."
"But the law compels you to take me if I ask for a room."
"Perhaps. But you'd make out a poor case to the magistrates in these particular circumstances."
"Then what about the—"
Here the fellow descended to implying that I did a fine trade in a very different kind of couple, for which I gave him what the bully deserved. Then I recounted to him the whole interview, everything of which he denied categorically, and I ended with, "So you're a liar yourself, a cad, and I'll do nothing to help you. I'm only sorry for the lady who's heard all this to her distress." I went back into the kitchen to carve meat, and I suppose he got back his bags and took his car away. I felt wounded at first. Then I rejoiced that the place had escaped a repetition of the dear old things that the average journalist has written about it, but with a novelty, perhaps, a hint that it was a place for a jolly weekend with a lady friend. Isa Fletcher, niece, very pretty, told me that someone had said I was getting on so well that I could afford to be rude to people. This is stupidly untrue. It's just the opposite. I was ruder still at the beginning, and it is just because I have been rude to people whom I don't like here that we are getting on.
That was Malcolm Greaves and his Honey Tones reading another episode of The Innkeeper's Diary. More of that next week. Well, next, Katie Austin, and here she is reporting on Bristol's Organic Food Fair.
Bristol prides itself on having a number of green credentials. It is, for example, the first cycling city in Europe. It's not surprising, therefore, that the Soil Association chose to hold their 9th organic food festival here this weekend. It's the largest event of its kind in Europe and takes over the entire Bristol waterfront. This includes the amphitheatre, waterfront square, a street food bazaar and the Millennium Square with a big organic food market. I went along to see whether the queues would be as big here as I knew they would be at Sainsbury's. Kerry Valentine is the volunteer coordinator here. I asked her why she's chosen to volunteer with this festival and what she thinks it means to Bristol. Why do you think it's important to Bristol right now?
I think so many events are happening in London and key places, and Bristol's got so many amazing grassroots organisations, and it brings people to see what's happening in the organic field in Bristol.
Cool, so let's go to the Kids Taster tent to see what's happening over there. Here, you're running the Kids Taste Tent. What are you trying to do here?
Well, we're running sensory education workshops to get the kids involved in understanding their senses so that they can make better food choices.
So, what did the apples taste like when you tasted them?
Yummy.
Yummy? So, are you going to try more apples after coming here? And it's not just for kids either. I'm here with Tom from Origin Coffee. Tom, what's it been like for you as an exhibitor?
The coffee's been great. It's gone down a storm. It's been real fun.
So in the words of the coffee merchant, it's gone down a storm. Let's speak to the general public. Hi, what's your name?
Catherine.
And what have you thought of the festival?
I think it's been absolutely fantastic. There's such a variety of stalls, something to please everyone. I'm really thrilled that I came this year.
So do you feel it's gone well? Do you want to be back next year?
We'd love to be back next year, but we're not sure if we will be. We don't know who's organising it yet, so we'll see.
So we'll just have to look out for other organic events in the meantime.
Yes, absolutely. Please do.
So the Organic Festival's over, but Organic Bristol certainly isn't. Check out shops near you for organic food, such as Wild Oats on White Ladies Road.
That was Katie Austin there, reporting on last weekend's Bristol's Organic Food Fair. Well, that's all for this week's show. Thank you very much to Ben Ritchie and to Abby Jamet for coming in for a chat. Dialect is a community internet radio station broadcast on Bristol Community FM. That's on 93.2 FM across the city, 9 p.m. every Saturday and repeats at 6 every Sunday evening. You can find us on the web, Dialect Radio, at dialectradio.co.uk and also at bristol.indymedia.org.uk. And if you listen to just BCFM generally, check them out on bcfm.org.uk. Dialect is a Bristol Radio co-op production, and that means anyone can contribute. So if you'd like to, either in reporting or engineering or making a cup of tea, you can just sort of come and hang out and see what you think of us. Do get in touch via Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733, or you can find them on the web at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. Again, thank you to Abby Jermaine, Ben Ritchie, reporters this week with Tony Gosling and Anthea Page, and the studio production was by Mark Condon. Well, that was Dialect Radio, and I'm John Peters Coleman, wishing you a very good week from all the team in our Queen Square studio in Bristol City Centre. Thank you for your company, and so until the same week, same time next week, goodbye.